This is the Florida Spectacular Podcast with your hosts, Kathy Silustri and Rick Kilby. Keep up with Kathy at greatfloridaroadtrip.com and on Twitter and Instagram at Kathy Silustri. Find Rick on Twitter at OldFLA and visit his website, rickkilby.com. Now, discover a Florida you never knew existed.
Welcome back to Florida Spectacular. Welcome back, Rick Kilby. How are you?
I'm great. We are actually taping this on September 4th, and something big happened on September 3rd that I'm excited to talk about.
I think you're more excited than I am, but let's go for it. I'll play dumb. What happened on September 3rd, Rick?
It was the official publish date for your second book, The Florida Spectacular. Or you lost the, right? It's just Florida Spectacular.
Yes, that was a big discussion with the editor and apparently a committee of people who sit around and think about book titles, and the had to go. So it is simply a Florida Spectacular, extraordinary places and exceptional lives, I think. I should know this by now.
I should probably look that up. I couldn't tell you the second part of my Florida Healing Waters book because, again, it's one of those things that you give the publisher a long list and they come back with what they like, and maybe there's some compromise and some back and forth, but you never really remember what they end up on.
There was a whole discussion, and I didn't realize there was a committee that talked about such things, but there is, and I has a lot of back and forth. And I mean, if you see my editor, just fire a drink at this point, because I was like, look, I try and be fairly easygoing when it comes to edits. Like, it's really not my hill to die on. It's right. I wrote the book. Their job is to make the book amazing. I know that my first drafts are not great. And I do know that there are some people who have worked with the press who have a reputation with them for being a diva and a problem and all that stuff. And I don't want to be that person. I don't want them to sit around and go, oh, Celestri, man, what a fucking nightmare she is. I will pretty much accept edits without question. But when it comes to the book cover and the title, I felt very strongly. And I did with the first book also. Fun fact, my first book, the title I had in mind for it was called Finding Florida, because it was about a road trip to discover old Florida. But this guy, T.D. Ullman, wrote a book and gave it that title right before, and then it came to light. He admitted he hadn't really researched. And so the press, I couldn't argue with them when they're like, look, we really don't think that's a good title. Like, no, I see it. I see it now. It's Florida Spectacular. And I think one of the things I had going for me in that argument about the title was that, look, I have a newsletter that has, you know, like 1,000 subscribers or more. I've got this podcast. People know the name, you know, and I don't know. I don't know what happened up there. Either they gave in or they saw reason, but I'm happy about it. But yes, the official launch date was yesterday. I've got a bunch of stuff all over the state, but depending on when you're listening to this podcast, you might not actually, it might be already passed. So
It's exciting, though. I remember when my first book came out, there's nothing like seeing the book for the first time. It's hard to beat that feeling. Holding it in your hands, you know, that labor of love. So how long did you work on this book?
Oh, so this is embarrassing. I started it in 2017. I had the idea for it. And I actually met with an editor from the press who has since moved on to another press. And they put me back with my original editor, Sean Hunter, who is, I think, a really, she's very good at working with writers. Let's put it that way. And I started working on it. I had an outline for chapters. It was initially a much longer book. But the relationship I had with that first editor was not, it wasn't quite the same as what I had with Sean. And actually, when she left and they put me back with Sean, I was really happy. And, you know, Sean looked through the manuscript and she says, can you tell me, you have this thing about Archibald, this chapter about Archibald. Why do I have 8 pages about the Roebling family building the Brooklyn Bridge? But why is this necessary? I'm like, oh, I see what you're saying. Yes. Okay. We can cut those 8 pages. She was very good about it. And somewhere along 2019, I decided I was going to scrap the project entirely. you know, the problem being, of course, I have a contract for a book with the press. So they were trying to, you know, Sean and I were workshopping a lot of different things. And for a few months, everything lay dormant. And it was actually a lunch with Craig Pittman. I remember this vividly. We went to Red Mesa Mercado in St. Pete. And I think we were having tacos. And I was like, Craig, I don't know what I'm going to write. I just, you know, he's like, why don't you just finish the book you started? What's you're halfway done. Just finish it. And I guess I just heard it at the right time. I'm like, oh, okay, I'll just finish it. And I did. So it just took a long time. I don't know why, but it did, and finished it. And then, of course, after you're done with your part of it, which includes the edits, which, you know, right? The edits.
Right.
I hate edits. I kind of just want to get to the point where I can be like, you know, just make, do whatever you want. I don't want to see it again. You know, change whatever you want. I won't be precious about it, but that's not how the publishing world works. They want you to go back and think about it and verify things, all this stuff. I'm being flippant, of course.
And so are you talking about the edits after it goes to readers or after that?
So any edits.
Oh.
Like any edits at all. Like Sean would send me the edits back and I would essentially just accept unless there was something she wanted me to do. Now, in this case, when this book went out to readers, it went out to 3 readers. And most of the comments were really good. There was one reader who was adamant, and I don't know if I'm giving too much information here and the press is going to hate me for it, but there was one reader who was adamant going, well, there's nothing about Black people and Black history. And my response to Sean was, this was 2020, we were dealing with George Floyd, I'm like, one, I am not a Black historian. There are people far more qualified to write about this than me. I said, two, I don't feel like there's a lot of bright spots right now. Like I'm having a hard time summoning the energy to write about something good for Black people in Florida. And we went back and forth on that. And what came out of that was chapter 6, which is Eatonville, Zora, Community, and Hope, which is, it was the last thing to get added to the book. And it was an interesting chapter to write because I was very aware and cognizant of the fact that, first of all, there are a lot of complications with Eatonville, and you live right by there. So I'm sure you drive around there, you know what they are. It's right by the I-4 eyesore. Doesn't have an exit. It's you try and drive to Eatonville, it's ridiculous how your GPS routes you. And you know, there's some issues. I'm very cognizant of that. And I was very concerned the whole way through, like, I'm going to get creamed on this chapter. It's the shortest chapter in the book. And I'm worried people are going to say it was an afterthought. And, you know, that was the biggest edit, was to add an entire chapter.
So do you have any regret? I mean, do you think that turned out well? Because when you talked to Cassafleas, you talked at length about Zora, and I thought you had done really in-depth research. It sounded good.
Well, I appreciate that. And I hope it's okay. I am just, you know, I think since 2020, and not because of the pandemic, but because of so many events that unfolded, I think a lot of us who are historians really have had to reexamine a lot of what we've learned about the history of any other, meaning Seminole Tribe of Florida, Black people, women, immigrants, anybody who is not a white Protestant, essentially. And I that gets ahead of you sometimes. Like with the Seminole Tribe of Florida, with the chapter on Polly Parker, I was very fortunate that I had Dave Scheidegger at the tribe, Tina Osceola. I knew people were going to be vetting that chapter. I knew that it was being, you know, my research was based on primary research that I could no longer do because the people were dead, but looking through the archives at the Seminole Tribe of Florida, looking at Albert Devane's research, he had an interview with, I believe, the granddaughter of Polly Parker. But after all that research, which is still, other than what's in the Seminole Tribe archives, that research is all just a bunch of white people interpreting events. Right. But I had the Seminole Tribe of Florida looking at looking at it, reading it. I mean, I have, when I was on the Welcome to Florida podcast, we talked about this. I have like 8 or 9 drafts of that chapter where we went back and forth. And at one point, you know, the tribe said, can you please check your notes and make sure that they said they heard owls, because in the tribe, an owl is a sign of death, and, you know, stuff like that. Like, they were very granular with it. I didn't have anybody doing that with Black history in Florida.
Oh, interesting.
So, I mean, it's still a white woman's interpretation of events that have impacted the Black community. And I mean, I think moving forward, historians have to find a way to work with this.
Yeah.
You know, when you talk about Eatonville as a whole, I went there, I went to the library. It was looking at all those things. I was walking the streets. I was trying to talk to people, but it's an outsider's perspective, no matter how you play it. There's no, when you talk about a historic event with the Seminole tribe and they have detailed records of it, they have a preservation office, but there's no commensurate thing with a lot of other marginalized groups. And so that's probably a very long way of saying that I hope I did a good job. I hope I represented what happened in Eatonville proudly. And I love how the community was so inventive when they were under threat. I love how they were very quick to go, well, hey, we're gonna capitalize on this. Zora Neale Hurston was born here. She grew up here. This is, you know, I love how they were able to fight back like that. So
do you get it all in some of the contemporary things that are going on in Eatonville with the Hungerford Academy and all, or did you just stay away from that? Because
I did not. Okay. I wanted to talk about that moment in time. I did not. And that stuff changes so fast.
Yeah.
So, I mean, this was still like a year and a half ago that I did the Eatonville chapter, and the book's just now coming out. And, you know, books, like Brad Bertelli, who is on the Florida Keys Spectacular podcast with me, our premium content, our listener supported stuff. He self-publishes, and he's a historian. I mean, he's the real deal, but he has chosen to break away from traditional publishing, and he is publishing his books basically through Amazon. And he can, at any time, if he finds out that something has changed or something, new information has come to light, he can change the book.
Right.
That doesn't happen with conventional publishing.
No.
So it makes me want to stay away from anything that's a current affair thing, because it will date the book very quickly.
I mean, I think that the best example of that is, this is a week after we did, or almost a week after we did our last podcast, where we talked about the situation with the state parks. The situation has changed drastically in the course of a week. If you were trying to put that into a book, there's no way you could be contemporary. You need to be years apart from it. And then the other thing, you know, you're writing about events in a lot of cases that happened 100, 150 years ago, but the way we perceive those is constantly evolving. And I think the best example are those two that you just gave. You know, the way we look at Black history now is the way different from the way we looked at Black history 10 years ago. The way we look at Native American history is different from the way we did 10 years ago too. And I think one of the things that I've learned from you on being on this podcast is how to come from a more kind of Native American centric point of view because of your work with the tribe down there. You know, for instance, it was a big lift for me to get over the fact that there weren't 3 Seminole Wars, you know, like historians have traditionally said and still say that there were 3, that they're in the minds of the Seminoles, that was one continuous conflict. And that makes so much sense now to me.
And that's hard for a lot of people. And that was a case where I was willing to accept what those historians had told me, the historians at TIPO. But because of my research, they were very, you know, they're very people. I think there's a reputation with the Seminole tribe that their Indians are hard to work. I've heard people say this, and my response is always, they weren't with me. Like, if you're trying to talk to them as a historian and tell them why their version of history is wrong, yeah, I can see where they're not going to be really open to that conversation. But when I'm like, well, how can I learn more? They open the archives. They have, from a historian's perspective, God bless the casinos. I mean, they've got this beautiful clean room. They've got, I mean, you walk into their archives, there's a sticky mat to get the dust off your feet. I mean, everything. And they were very willing. They said, come on in. Here's our index. Let us know what you want to see and we'll bring it out to you. And they did. I mean, and so I could see where since basically the Red Stick War, which is not something we talk about, all the way through the start of the Civil War, there was never a time where the U.S. government wasn't involved in actively, there's no other word for it, hunting Indians. I mean, it's hunting Seminole Indians. And it was an eye opener for me. A lot of it is, and I've had people tell me I'm wrong. I mean, we had a, somebody, Eckerd College by us has some Chickies on their campus, and in them they have some verbiage on a plaque talking about it being, essentially, it's basically a stolen land admission, but talking about the tribe going back millennia. And we had one of our writers at the newspaper write about that. And someone was so upset by this that they impersonated a USF college professor and came after us on Twitter and sent us emails and was really upset by this. This is really a hot button issue. It seems to be that people feel like any admission of a non-white dominated historical narrative is a threat.
Yeah. Yeah. I get that.
I had a man come up to me at a talk. I was talking about the Seminole Wars, the Seminole War period. And I was talking about, we talk about the Trail of Tears a lot in American history, but we don't talk about Florida in that. And I was talking about that. And I had a man come up to me at the end of the talk and he goes, well, I think you're misrepresenting it. They got free education and some of them wanted to go to Oklahoma.
Oh, God.
And I didn't know what to say to him. I mean, what do you say to that? I'm like, well, that's not how they see it, sir. You know, that's not been their impression of it.
I think that's the best way you can say it, is that's not how they see it. I think that, you know, I was thinking about that this morning, is that I've had a similar point of view. And how do you get people to relearn something that they have taken as fact? How do you get them to abandon something that they've invested in and see it from a different perspective outside of what they've learned? You know, people still believe that the Ponce de Leon came to Florida looking for the Fountain of Youth, you know, because that's what they were taught. They believe it's in St. Augustine. They believe it's in that attraction in St. Augustine, and they don't want to hear anything other because that's what they were taught. They heard that the cracker came from the sound of the whip, you know, and all that stuff. And if we show them evidence of the contrary, there's resistance. How do you overcome that? I mean, I struggle with that.
So I don't. No, and I don't want to generalize, but it does seem, I almost feel like this is something that's going to have to change with the passage of time. I gave a local library that has homeschool kids come in, asked me if I would come speak about the Seminole tribe. They got my name from somebody and I said, well, I'm not a tribal representative. And they said, that's okay. We understand it, but we'd like you to talk about what you learned there. And, you know, of course I have these stereotypes in my mind. We all do. And I'm thinking homeschool, and I immediately go to, I immediately go to a definition of the type of person who homeschools in my mind that is not somebody who is necessarily open to new ideas. And that's me. That's all me. We just lost all the homeschool parents. But I was thinking, you know, these, a lot of times you see these, Christian, heavily Christian families do it. And sometimes those are people who are, they're a Bible first situation. And depending on the type of church they go to, they might not be encouraged to really explore the Bible in a more fleshed out sense. So that's what I was worried about. I'm like, well, I'm going to be giving them this history that's going to fight with this manifest destiny, which is, you know, of course, God's will that we have everything in America. And I couldn't have been more wrong. And these kids, and it was hard because it was like 4-year-olds up through teenagers, but the parents were there. And the parents were super interested in this. They wanted to know more and they didn't have any trouble with it. But I will say they were all younger than me. I get more resistance when I say, well, this is what I learned from the Seminole Tribe of Florida. I get more resistance from older people. Not all older people by far. I think academics, I think academic historians are really going to struggle with it. And until we start changing the narrative of how we teach history, starting in grade school, I think it's going to be hard. And especially, it seems like critical thinking maybe isn't getting focused on as heavily as it could be in some curriculums now in Florida. But, you know, one of the chapters in my book talks about the idea that there weren't 13 colonies, there were 22. And I love when I talk about that, because I had a woman raise her hand at the end of the talk. She had to be, in her 70s. She's some retired teacher. She says, "I taught kids wrong for years and I'm horrified." And I said, "Well, that's probably because you were taught something different." You know, that Florida was not on the winning side of that. So we've got to change there. And it doesn't mean we have to say everything we've taught people about history is wrong. I think what we have to say is there's more than one way to look at this historic event. And I think we teach history as a very black and white thing, and it's not. I was, again, when I was on Craig and Chad's podcast, I paraphrase something. I listened to this science fiction podcast. It's a drama, and it's actually a comedy. It's wonderful, called Midnight Burger. And they do a lot of stuff. But there was this great line in it a couple of weeks ago on the podcast where a woman says, "Well, the event, there's a thing that happens. And the minute the thing is done happening, people start interpreting how it happened. So there is no real true version of history. It's all just different interpretations of what happened." Even things like who won the battle. We have battles where we talk about the American military being triumphant. But if you look at both sides, the original accounting from both sides of the ancestors of the Seminole Tribe of Florida and the U.S. military, the U.S. military lost more people. Yeah. I mean, it's a really complicated issue.
That's our theme. It's complicated.
It's complicated. So, that's the T-shirt.
We're talking a lot about history, but one of the things, because I don't have your book, but I have an early draft that you shared with me, is that what comes through when I see it is you have as a writer, you have a very powerful voice, you know, that it doesn't read like a history. Like I feel like when I write this, you know, in Florida's Healing Waters, I was really just trying to find factual information and kind of weave it into stories and tell those stories. But I will never have the voice that you have, you know, and that's to me what really shines through in your writing. And it, I was also reading Tyler Gillespie. Is that his name?
Yes.
I was reading that when I was out of town a few weeks ago, and he's another writer I think has a very, very, very strong voice. That, you know, your personality comes through. So you're telling these facts, these historical things, but you know, your personality is shining through it, and it makes it an easier read than if it were just the facts.
Thank you. I had, I in the back of the book, I don't think you have a copy with the acknowledgements. I talk about my mom and dad. They were both, my mom, I think still is, very creative people. So I would get these bedtime stories. You know, other kids had bedtime stories read to them. My parents made up stories. Like, my dad would make up stories about a penguin who drove a race car. My mom would tell these moralistic stories about two sisters, one who was really good and one who was really bad. So I think I picked up on some of that. But, you know, also in grad school, I was introduced to the idea of the braided narrative, that it was okay to write about history and write about the environment and to have a through line in it, which they don't teach you in conventional high school and even undergrad writing. I mean, it was really an eye opener, and I enjoy it. You know, it's also, I think part of it is that for a long time, well, not for a short time in my 20s, I did public relations for a water utility. And so a good part of my job was taking engineer speak and making it into brochures that were palatable for people to understand why their water was safe to drink or why you couldn't put fertilizer in your garbage can. And then after that, reporting for so many years on city council, it became clear to me that people feel disenfranchised when they don't understand something, and bureaucracy is all, you know, it's very passive voice. It's very, No one wants the blame. No one. So this was given to and utilized. And so in reporting on city council, I always thought as my job is to explain to people what happened every week, what city council was doing with their money. And I found that people responded to that. And when I wrote my first book, Backroads, I wrote a narrative master's thesis about taking 20 some odd road trips. And I remember it was, what did Gary Mormino say? He said it was the least academic master's thesis he had ever read. And that was like the nicest thing. You know, it was like the nicest thing for him to say. It's the least academic thing because I have read so much academic writing that is so boring.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I like to tell stories. I had Jim Schnur, who used to be the archivist at the USF Library. He told me something once and it stuck with me for a long time. He said, you know, Kathy, no one really cares what time Rosa Parks got on the bus, but if you can talk about what color her shoes were, people are going to remember that. And that's true. Names and dates are not as important as things like that. I mean, it's one thing to talk about. This is the woman who escaped through the swamp. And she got back home and all these people after her that are related to her did these great things. But if you talk about that moment where she was in the swamp with I think five or six other women and they were all petrified. They were going to be recaptured and she was sick and she was begging them to go on without her and leave her. And they refused to do it. I mean, that's a better story. That's what, if we taught that, people would remember it. And so I am probably not taken very seriously by a lot of academics, and that is 100% okay with me because I know my research is solid. And I think that you have more power in reaching people who don't want to read in a classroom than you do by reaching the people who are in the ivory towers. It's just lost all the academics.
Well, You're not, that's not who you're writing to. That's not your audience. That's not what you're trying to achieve. I mean, I had a definite goal in mind with Florida's Healing Waters. My goal was, you know, I wanted to make, you know, these medical tourists that they're a part of Florida's history and, you know, part of Florida's early tourism history. I wanted to shine a light on that so that people would give it more than a cursory glance. Cause you know, there's a great book called, I think it's called Sunshine Paradels about Florida's tourism history. And there's like a paragraph about, you know, Florida's Healing Waters. I wanted to change that. I mean, that was my goal. So when you were writing this, I mean, with the name Florida Spectacular, were you trying to shift perception for people's view of Florida, or did you have a goal in mind?
I hate the concept of Florida Man. I hate it. And it's long before Florida Man. The only thing I hate as much as the concept of Florida Man is the concept that there's some sort of real Florida. Because
it
implies that if you don't live in that kind of thing, why should you care about it? I had a point, and I talk about this sometimes. This was my original introduction to the book until I ended up drinking cheap champagne out of a conch shell. 9/11, 2001, I was at a business trip I was at a water reuse symposium in San Diego, California. And I ended up on a Greyhound bus, and it was the one that made all the local stops from, I believe, Phoenix, Arizona to Tallahassee. And it took 3 days. Two of those days were spent in Texas. I mean, it was, in retrospect, if it was not such a horrific event, it's almost a comedy, right? Like, comedy is born of tragedy. There were riots. There was, every bus stop that we made, it was horrible. And there were four of us who had been on the bus together since Phoenix who were all trying to get back to Florida for various reasons. By the time the Greyhound bus obviously was packed with people who were not used to riding a bus. But by the time we crossed the state line into Florida on I-10. People cheered and clapped. And that's always stuck with me. I remember thinking, you know, if we're so awful, why are these people cheering to be back here? Why are we growing so quickly? Why do people save their money all year, either to spend it on a beach or to go to Disney World and Universal or the Keys? Like, if we're so bad, why are we so popular? And if you start to look, I mean, I think there's a historic case to be made that we've been set up to be made fun of since the very beginning, because we've made all these very unpopular decisions, you know, Revolutionary War, no, go to hell. We want to be part of the crown, you know, Civil War, no, we're going to secede. I mean, I don't think we made the best decisions, but it's just kind of set us up to be the dog that everybody wants to kick. And it's contraindicated with how popular we are. So you know, you start seeing Florida Man, I'm like, no, we're more than that. And I really wanted people to feel good. I wanted people to feel good about being Floridians. I wanted people to be able to Floridasplain. I wanted them to be able to say, you know, you're at a dinner party and someone goes, oh my God, you're Florida. I'm down here in Florida. You people are so backwards and you don't have any good pizza and, you know, whatever, no good bagels. Well, I want them to be able to go, well, actually, did you know? And then launch into a whole thing that made this Yankee understand, well, wait a minute, I have to rethink what I know about Florida. This is pretty cool. You know, like what more springs than anywhere else on the planet? What's that about? And, you know, it was, if anything, the criticism I got and from the early readers is that my book was positive. And it was like, well, what the hell? Yes, it's positive.
You're a better storyteller, because when I, you know, if people say something to me about springs and I start going on and on, I see their eyes start to glaze over. It's like, we have over 1,000 springs, the largest array of freshwater springs in the United States, in the world, you know, and their eyes start to glaze over. It's like, here he goes again. He's going to start talking about nitrogen and phosphorus. Please go away.
I think I'm good in short bursts. I think a 30-minute podcast with me is really great. My staff at the paper, when I start into it, they'll be like, Kathy, what did we do wrong? Why are we getting Florida facts? Like, they see it as punishment.
There's a book that I have. I think it's called The Idea of Florida. And it's about in the literary tradition or something like that. And it's all different pieces. And it almost seems like there's the real Florida and then there's the idea of Florida. And they kind of are interlocked. And part of the reason why people come here is they have a Florida in their mind before they even get here. You know, like Idaho, you know, I can't think of anything about Idaho.
It's super popular right now.
Idaho?
Apparently California's full. And Idaho, people are writing letters to people selling their homes, basically going, pick me because I want to live here the most. Yeah, Idaho's gotten crazy, but I'm with you. I'm like, potatoes. Okay.
Yeah, I didn't know that. But everybody has a perception of Florida. You know, the bad thing about Florida Man, and I'm not a fan either, is that it has shifted people's perception. You know, before, what was it? I was watching some stupid thing of Friends, and they talked about, you know, 50 years from now, and one of the characters said, I'll be playing shuffleboard. You know, that's it. You know, Florida is someplace where you go and you wear really, you know, old people clothes and you play shuffleboard and you go grow old there. Jerry Seinfeld had a great line about that too.
They didn't want to move to Florida, but they turned 65 and it's the law.
It's the law.
It's the
law.
And
that's the thing. Now it's been replaced by stupid Florida Man, which is ubiquitous.
So, you know, I have a short little anecdote we can end on with that. And that is that, I don't know, maybe 10 years ago, 9 years ago, I was at a conference, Florida Historical Society, maybe, and I was on a panel with, I think it was Kim Voss and Peggy Donaldson, and I was something to do with Florida Man, and I had like a 10-minute talk about essentially the idea of why real Florida and Florida Man were both bad for Florida, like how both conceits were not good for the state. And I was really tearing into the whole weird Florida thing. And when it came time for questions, a guy in the back raised his hand. He goes, well, I'm Elliot Kleinberg, and I wrote that first weird Florida book in 1999. And, you know, of course, what do you say to that? Other than, yeah, I have your Black Cloud book, and I think I quoted it. I think it's a beautiful book. I loved Black Cloud. Did not love Weird Florida. But that was, I should not be allowed to meet people. When I met Dave Barry, I was moments away from telling him he looked like Dave Barry because I didn't really realize he was Dave Barry. that haunts me still. I had no idea. I'm watching the guy in this Books and Books bookstore in Key West. And he's like, God damn, that looks like Dave Barry. And I'm about to go up to him and say something. And the guys, I was there for a book sign, and the guy he's with brings him over. And he's like, oh, Kathy, I want to introduce you to Dave Barry. And I was like, oh, thank God.
Well, I predict that's going to happen to you now that you've got the second book out and the podcast and all this. I do have a question, though. So did the idea for the name of the podcast, your newsletter, was that because you were doing a book of the same name? Because I always assumed the reason it's called the Florida Spectacular Podcast is it's linked to your book. But is it unrelated?
I mean, of course it's related.
Okay.
I mean, I fought for the title of the book because I had built this in, but I mean,
it's a brand. You built a brand.
Florida Splaining. I mean, if we're going to change the name of the podcast ever, we're just going to call it Florida Splaining because that's what I do. But I don't see myself ever in a position where I am writing nonfiction about Florida or nonfiction about anything, honestly, that isn't positive about Florida. So, I mean, it was more of a brand than the book. There'll be another book after this. I'm already in conversation with the press about my next book, and it's not quite as positive, but hopefully inspirational. It wasn't all to promote the book, if that's what you're asking. I enjoy talking about Florida every week, and it several hundred people a week seem to enjoy it too, at least.
I really hope listeners.
Well, so I'll tell you, now this is going long, and I love talking about me. It's your fault, Rick. You should let me talk about me.
You deserve it. Your book came out. You deserve it.
Well, thank you, but
7 years in the making. It's a slog.
I mean, Stephen King writes that in an hour, though. It's, you know. So when Backroads of Paradise came out, 3 months, I think, after it came out, I got an email from the New York Times, and they wanted to interview me, and they did, and they put me in their Sunday travel section, and I became addicted that Sunday to watching my book ranking on Google or on Amazon because it went insane, and I got emails from people, and I was not ready for it. I didn't have anything in place to reach out to these people ever again. There was no way for them other than email. I had a website. It was very static. So I was determined that if I was going to write a second book, that if people noticed the book, I wanted ways for them to engage more. I wanted them to keep learning and keep enjoying it. So that's why I have the newsletter. I have the podcast, all those things, because I want people who get excited about what I write to be able to find ways to stay excited about Florida.
Yeah, I think that's true. I enjoy continuing to do research about the stuff in my books, and like when I find new stuff, and I try and always, if I haven't done any social media posts, go back and dig a little bit deeper and see if I can find more. And I'm always, if I find a new photograph, it's like, oh, I've never seen this before. It's exciting to me. And, you know, of course, my stuff's always visual based. And, you know, I don't know if I have another book in me or not.
I hope you do, because people love your book.
Oh, thanks.
I hear everyone, when I say your name and people know, oh my God, I love his book. Oh my God, I got to get his book. Oh my God, Rick Kilby. So you're like a little Springs rock star.
Oh, thanks.
No,
it's fine. I feel good because I know if my book wasn't popular, I'd find it in thrift stores. That people will have gotten rid of it. And I've seen it once in like a thrifty antique place, but people seem to keep my book once they buy it. And that to me is the ultimate compliment. And they buy my book. That's the other thing is, you know, you do a talk and somebody buys your book. To me, that's the ultimate compliment. And I love it. There's so much satisfaction when people want to engage with you after you do a talk, you know, and tell you their stories. And that's the hard thing that I really missed during the pandemic when my book came out, is that lack of connection. So I hope you get to have that when you do your talk.
I hope so, too. I'll find out tomorrow. I'm going to my first talk up in Tallahassee. So,
Midtown Reader? Are you doing Midtown
Reader? Yeah, I love Midtown Reader. I like
that's
Midtown
awesome.
Reader. I like any small bookstore. Like I, my challenge is going to be getting out of the bookstore without spending any money. Like, always a problem.
Maybe you could do some kind of trade or something. I don't know.
No. I the next time you're on this side of the world, you can look at my book closet and my book stacks, and you can just have an intervention. Somebody needs to. Anyway, thank you, Rick. That was really nice that you wanted to talk about my book. So.
Oh, I've been so excited about it, and I just feel like this is such a, we need your book. You know, that's the thing. We need it. The the headlines are tough. There's positive sides of what's been going on in Florida lately. It seems like there's finally some pushback, and but I'm, you know, the stuff we talked about with the state parks, I'm not sure we're through that yet. You know, that maybe this is just we're putting it on pause and it's going to rear its ugly head. I have no doubt, actually, just a matter of when. So, you know, we need the positive stuff, and that encourages us, and hopefully we get more invested in trying to, you know, fight for what's important. I think that's, for me, the underlying thing is that let's not sit around and moan and groan about what we've lost. Let's dig in and fight for what we got still in Florida.
I agree. I mean, it's there's a lot of really good stuff, and we need to celebrate that.
Yeah, there really is a lot of really good stuff. There really is.
So, and if you don't believe me, just email us it. Actually, you can just go to the podcast show notes. There's a way to reach out to us there now. And we are happy to answer your questions and Florida-splain to you, because that's what we do.
Yay! And it's complicated.
It is complicated. Welcome to Florida. It's complicated.
Well, I mean, we can't say welcome to Florida. That's a different podcast.
I know. Well, yeah. It's okay.
Florida's spectacular.
It's complicated. All right. I will see you next week. I will hear you all next week, or at least you'll hear us. Thanks for listening, everybody. Have a great week.